The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. Welcome to a Wednesday, everybody. I'm checking. It appears we are firing on all cylinders. Progressive Voices, check. YouTube, check. Facebook? Let's see. Facebook, you going? We'll find out momentarily, I believe. Definitely Twitter and Twitch and LinkedIn. All working, I think. Hi. Welcome aboard, everybody. And let your friends know we're here. We're also, yes, on YouTube. Facebook appears to be working, I think. We appear to be everywhere we're supposed to be. Sorry about the last couple of days. You know, I try to make things better in here, but it's like the Springsteen song, one step up and two steps back. It seems every time I try to make things better, I have a momentary setback. But, you know, it's all good. We're getting there. Speaking of getting there, wow, what a weird last few days it's been. I'm still reeling yet from yesterday's testimony. It was the first day, the first hearing by the new commission, the select committee. Sorry, not a commission. That would the independent commission is what the Republicans voted down. That would have had a the same number of members appointed by Democrats and Republicans. They all would have had subpoena power, but they said no. And in fact, these Republicans voted against the committee that's now in existence, the Special Select House Committee, even though they basically gave Kevin McCarthy every concession he asked for. The problem is, Kevin McCarthy doesn't call the shots. It's the orange guy, the former guy, who I think now is in New Jersey at Bedminster because it's too hot for him down here in Florida in the summer. So the testimony, I think, was so powerful. I thought Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, as much as I dislike their stance on just about every issue imaginable, at least they know an insurrection when they see one, and they know a crooked government when they see one. They know a crazy man when they see one. So, you know, last week I got to speak with Michael C. Bender from the Wall Street Journal, who has a new book out. And the book was titled this.
Win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
Frankly, we did win this election. That's what Michael C. Bender's book title was. And today I speak with Philip Rooker of The Washington Post, whose book title is... It's coming. Hold on.
Which is why I alone can fix it.
You know, obviously, both of those book titles were taken for the braggadocio nonsense that the orange guy spewed. You know, it's funny. Phil Rooker, actually, I taped the interview with him a few hours ago. He's on radio duty today because I'm sitting in my studio getting ready to tape with him. And I've got Tom Hartman playing in the background. And who do I hear come on Tom Hartman's show but Philip Rooker? And so when he got on the line, I said, oh, I guess you pick the short straw. You get to deal with all the radio folks. So anyway, we had a good conversation. He will join us in a little while through the magic of tape. But before we get there, a couple of things that I want to share with you. I played a lot of clips yesterday from the hearing. I was still sort of shell-shocked because it was powerful. It was not only powerful, it was depressing. And of course, the thing that was so depressing about it is knowing that the idiots who need to see this, who needed to hear it, are ignoring it. So over on the fake news network, you know who I'm talking about, these guys.
Your original source for fake news. Fox News. We make shit up.
Yeah, the people that make shit up. They purposely don't watch this. So I did see some of the roundups of like Laura Ingraham, who's like, I'm going to give out acting awards to the people who cried. Fuck you. Really? I mean, come on. So I was really surprised to see this video pop up. I'm going to play it for you from YouTube. It is the Fox, not News Network. And, well, as soon as the hearing ended, they threw to Bette Baier, their actual news guy, who watched it and actually had something constructive to add to the conversation.
Baier, who's been watching the proceedings there on Capitol Hill. You heard Harry Dunn there at the closing saying that a lot of people have said that this is political. He said, well, January the 6th was political. And he said, telling the truth shouldn't be hard. We did hear some compelling testimony, Brett. Saw a lot of very dramatic video that we saw initially play during the president's impeachment hearings some months ago.
You didn't, because you didn't air it.
Yeah, John, Sandra, good afternoon. I've watched every minute of this.
Yeah.
And if you were watching, you saw compelling, at times damning, emotional testimony from
yeah.
these four officers
yeah.
who fought the line to try to protect the Capitol and the lawmakers inside.
They did.
For anybody who looked at that and looked at the videos and their testimony about that day and thought that it was not violent, I think that was an eye-opener.
Hello.
We've obviously talked about January 6th a lot in this time since then, but putting it all together and seeing it again is jarring. And
yes.
to listen to these officers say how they really fought to hold on to their lives. Officer Michael Fanone, who you mentioned, mm-hmm. Saying that he was getting beaten. And finally, when he thought that it was almost coming to an end, that he was going to die, he
yeah.
yelled out, I have kids, to try to get some sympathy from the people who were beating him. He then went on to, in that opening statement, say how upset he was and how upset he was with the indifference of some lawmakers to that day, or downplaying the significance of that day, at one point slamming his hand on the table and saying this cannot stand. I think that while Republicans politically are saying that this is a partisan effort and that they charge that it's not going to get to the questions that they think are important about January 6th, why were the Capitol Police so ill-prepared for what happened that day, you cannot watch this testimony and say that it's not a big deal.
You cannot watch this testimony and say that it was not a big deal. I wonder if his colleagues heard that. Now, I'm not going to play for you the swill that spewed from the loins of, you know, Laura Ingraham and Sean Insanity and Fucker Carlson. I know I'm stooping to their level when I use those kind of names, but it shines a spotlight on their insanity. Seriously. So Bette Baier mentioned Michael Fanone pounding his fist on the table. I neglected to play this clip yesterday, but it certainly bears hearing.
So many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad.
Right.
The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
Whoa. Yeah.
My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door, even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day, and in doing so, betray their oath of office.
And that says it all, really. I mean, these people, these four men and a few hundred others put their lives on the line to protect them. And this is the payback they get. The idiots like the guy from Georgia who, you know, is fighting, saying he's the one who said it was a tourist day. and then argued with Jamie Raskin when he called him out on it. I'm sorry. The double talk, double speak, however it goes, the gaslighting is ridiculous already. It's beyond ridiculous. Like, enough already. So if we have time at the end of the interview, we'll get back to some of this. But, I mean, you know, we spent a lot of time on it yesterday. A few other news items happening that I should let you know about, the most important being the status of the so-called BIF, the so-called Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework. They were supposed to have a deal done by Monday, right? Monday. And now we hear that there's they've come to a deal. They have an agreement, sort of. Here, reading from, I think this is from Politico. Senate negotiators and the White House have agreed to a final-ish version of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Framework. While we still don't have legislative language, the agreement is complete enough that Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he will move to a cloture vote as early as tonight, seemingly with the knowledge that 10 Republicans and all 50 members of the Democratic caucus will advance the legislation. Here's the problem, and you know her well, Kyrsten Sinema. Kyrsten Sinema, who was one of the lead negotiators on this piece of shit, I'm sorry, on the BIF, is now saying, well, I know we talked about, you know, doing a reconciliation bill too, but I'm not willing to spend $3.5 trillion. I'm just not. So if this all falls apart, that's who you blame. Kyrsten Sinema again. Go figure. I'm just, it's mind-blowing. It's just mind-blowing. Why this woman has so much power, I do not understand. It's just horrible. One other bit of electoral curiosity, I suppose, is there was a special election yesterday for a House seat in Texas. It was the seat of a guy whose name I don't remember, who had been elected, a Republican who was elected to Congress, and he died of the COVID before he could be sworn in. Remember that? So the special election was last night. Donald Trump endorsed Susan Wright, the guy's widow. He even took a trip to Texas and did an event for her to push her, and they put a lot of money into it. And she lost big time. She was defeated by, you know, by a standard run-of-the-mill politician, a guy who's actually, you know, been in, held elected office before. I don't have all the details on this. We'll talk to Howie Klein about it tomorrow. But just maybe some of the Teflon is starting to wear off of old Donnie boy. You know, maybe, perhaps. All right. I think we shouldn't wait any longer. We can come out on the other side and talk about it, but I want to get to the conversation with Philip Rooker. So let's not even wait any longer, right? Let's just get to it. All right. Take it away, Nicole. I'm very excited to welcome Philip Rooker to the show. This is the first time we've met. Phil is, but I've seen you a million times on television, of course, and I read you in the Washington Post. Philip is the the White House bureau chief for the Washington Post and the author, along with his co-writer Carol Lenig of the also of the Washington Post, of "I Alone Can Fix It: Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year." You guys also collaborated on the book "Very Stable Genius." A while back. First of all, congratulations on the success of both of them.
Thank you, Nicole. It's so cool to talk with you today. So thanks for having me.
Oh.
And eager to jump right in.
Good. So. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. So I got to ask, you know, I've read you for years. You saw you from the beginning to the end of the Trump administration. Obviously, you and Carol are not shills for the former president. He did not sit for your first for an interview for the first book, which I believe he referred to as fiction, a work of fiction. But he did agree to an interview for this one. Why do you think the change?
You know, it's an interesting thing to think about. I don't know exactly why he changed his view about our book, But, you know, I think he decided for the second book that he wants to have a hand in trying to curate history. And Donald Trump has this outsized view of his ability to persuade and the power of his charisma. And I, honest to God, I think he thought that if he invited Carol and I down to Mar-a-Lago and gave us all of his spin, we would leave somehow convinced that he had won the election and it was stolen, or somehow convinced to see the whole world and to see all the catastrophes of the last year through his eyes. And, you know, we're not that gullible. We're pretty hard-nosed reporters and ask tough questions and do a lot of independent research. And so we were happy to go down there and talk to him. I think it's really important for the act of journalism to hear different perspectives. And especially when we're writing a book about a principal like Trump, to have him be an active participant in the process and to hear his responses to our questions. But we certainly did not leave with his worldview.
No, but he obviously knows that you don't agree with his worldview, but he tried to convince you. Now, the question is, do you push back in a situation like that when you know this man is lying to you? You know, he's looking you right in the eye and he's telling you something blatantly wrong. Do you call him out on that, or do you just take note of, you know, he's lying again?
You know, we had to make a decision about this interview because he literally lied in what seemed like every sentence of the conversation. And it was a 2-hour, 45-minute conversation. There was a lot of just junk that came out of his mouth. And, you know, had this been an interview with an audience, like a live television or radio interview where people were listening and watching, I think we would have interrupted him every time to say, sir, that's wrong. Sir, there's no evidence for that. Sir, you have the facts incorrect here. Sir, that's a lie. But that wasn't this kind of an interview. This was a book interview. We knew that the things that he said, we would be putting into our own context, and we would be able to fact check him in the narrative, in the pages of the book. And so we challenged him on some of the things that were really preposterous, but other things we let slide for the sake of continuing the conversation, because we saw more value for our book and for ourselves as journalists, but also for the public, for the readers, more value in continuing the conversation and hearing what he had to say on other topics than, you know, challenging him back and forth and going all the way down the rabbit hole of, you know, whether there was a box of ballots under the trees, under the table skirt in Fulton County, Georgia, after the water main break. Like, right. That's the kind of stuff he was talking about. So
when you got there, you go to Mar-a-Lago, you don't sit in his office for the interview. He sets up in the lobby so everyone can see, ooh, these Washington right. Post reporters came here to talk to me, because he, I guess, still needs that validation. Did he say anything like about the first book when you first sat down? I mean, or did he welcome you with open arms like your old friends?
No, he welcomed us in like we were old friends. And, you know, I guess I sort of am an old friend. I've covered him for years. Right. And during the 2016 campaign, I interviewed him multiple times, and we had a relationship. I mean, we know each other. He followed my work when I was in the White House press corps. So he was trying to be warm and welcoming and charismatic and gregarious and gratuitous, even making sure we felt comfortable. But it was such a strange environment. Like, you would normally do an interview like this with some privacy,
sure,
like in his office. I mean, we're talking about really serious and in some cases sensitive matters. And yet we did so at his request on the couches in the lobby of Mar-a-Lago at 5 p.m. right before the dinner hour. So
of
the
course.
Club members are arriving during the interview, waving hello, coming by to say, to kiss the ring and see how Trump was doing as they made their way out to the patio to get their tables for dinner. And it wasn't just the dinner guests who were, you know, eavesdropping on the conversation, but it was the Mar-a-Lago staff, because all around the lobby, around the walls of the lobby, is where they set up the dinner buffet.
Oh,
so you had like the guy putting the bed of ice with all the oysters and the raw shrimp out for people to take, and you had another lady who was setting up the frying pan for Bananas Foster so they would have the dessert station, and another person with the pasta station. And, you know, they're all around us, and we're talking about election fraud and January 6th, and the shrimp guy is listening. So it was quite a scene.
That's all really surreal. Did he at least offer you dinner?
You know, he did. He was a welcoming host, to his credit. And as soon as we finished the conversation, he said, you know, please stay for dinner. He got the maitre d' to go find us a table in the back, and it's a buffet. So we just got plates and had some of the dinner. And, you know, we of course are journalists and try to be fair. So we wanted to pay for it ourselves, but there was not really a delicate way to do that. So we ended up paying the tip ourselves. So we didn't totally dine out on his account, but nonetheless, he was indeed a gracious host. And even after 2.5 hours of tough questioning, he wanted to make sure we were comfortable at the dinner table.
Wow. Now, have you heard from him since the book has been released, or since stories have been coming out from it? No, not at all. No,
not personally, although he has issued a number of statements. You know, he can't do Twitter anymore.
Right.
So his statements come out through email. Aww. He has issued a number of statements attacking the reporting in the book and attacking some of the people who are prominent characters in our book, including General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But he has not called me or Carol personally or anything like that. Nor, by the way, would we expect him to.
Okay. So he just throws it out there, hopes that his charm offensive will work on you. Obviously it doesn't,
yeah.
Because you're pros. But you mentioned General Mark Milley. I believe after reading, watching the events unfold over the last year of his administration, reading, as much as I've read of your book, I'm not through it yet because I just got it. And others that are out there, I really think the reason we're sitting here today talking and things are as they are, is because of Mark Milley. I think if not for Mark Milley, there are chances that things would have gone very differently on January 6th than even before. Do you think I'm off base?
I think you're onto something there. I mean, Mark Milley is a really important character, especially in these final months of the Trump presidency. And, you know, we knew who he was in Washington, but the details about the extent to which he was a bulwark protecting America's democracy from Trump, those details have not come out until this book and our reporting in this book. And let me just take a minute and explain who Mark Milley is. He's
Please.
Not a political figure. Mm-mm. He's not a political appointee. He's a student of history. He's very well read. He keeps lots of books about, you know, European history, American history, world history in his home. He was appointed by Trump to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is, of course, the highest ranking military position in the United States. But he's not a political actor. He's an advisor to the commander in chief about military matters. So Milley, after the June 1st clearing of Lafayette Square in the wake of George Floyd's killing, remember, Trump had the federal agents clear peaceful protesters outside the White House so he could walk across the park to do the Bible photo op in front of St. John's Church.
Hard to forget
after that moment.
Yes.
Yeah. After that horrific day, Mark Milley vowed to himself he would never again allow the U.S. military to be used for political purposes or for a political event of that nature. And he was on guard all the way through the remaining half of the year 2020 and Trump's presidency. But after the election, and Milley started to hear Trump talking about election fraud and it being rigged and stolen and claiming conspiracies that were just completely debunked and not true, Milley started to draw parallels to Adolf Hitler's rise in Nazi Germany and thought in Trump's rhetoric, he heard Hitler in 1933. When MAGA supporters came into Washington in December for a protest, Milley told aides it was like brown shirts in the streets, another Nazi reference.
That's right.
And then in the run-up to January 6th, Milley was on guard that Trump would try to use the military to stage a coup, that he thought the commander-in-chief would deploy military forces in order to stay in power despite the democratic will of the people in a free and fair election. That's chilling and extraordinary to think about. But that's what the top leader at the Pentagon thought and feared. And the other joint chiefs, the heads of the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and the other branches, they had similar fears. And they together all formulated a plan. So if Trump were to issue some sort of unconstitutional or illegal order, they would all resign one by one in a reverse Saturday night massacre.
Wow.
And you're right to seize on Milley, because I think in those final weeks, Milley was really saw himself as the barrier between the fall of our democracy and kind of just hanging on until January 20th when a new president got in.
Ah, I think he definitely was. Philip Rucker is with us. We're talking about the new book, I Alone Can Fix It. And this, I think, was a major turning point because as much as we had hoped there were people in the White House who were the adults in the room, we, of course, saw the New York Times op-ed and then the book from, quote, Anonymous. It turns out it wasn't such a high-ranking official who probably had no power to keep him in line. But there were those of us out here who were petrified, just hoping that there was somebody in that position who could do it. And in retrospect, it turns out it looks like it was Mark Milley. I also, though, thought all along, I mean, I was wrong on so many levels leading up to this point. During the campaign, I thought there's no way the Republican Party is going to let this guy be their nominee. I just didn't think it could happen. And yet, when he started winning primaries, it's like the rest of the party just rolled over to let him have his way. And damned be the facts, damned be history, anything that's, you know, the norms of how things have worked in this country for two centuries, they just cleared the way for Donald Trump. Did that surprise you as much as it did me?
You know, it was surprising to think about outside of the context, but at the time I was covering the campaign and I was at a lot of those Trump rallies and I could feel the energy on the ground. And you just knew there was something powerful happening in this campaign that was not happening in the 15 other Republican presidential campaigns. There was no passion and enthusiasm for Jeb Bush, for example,
right,
or for Marco Rubio or any of those other Republicans. So when you saw this transpiring in state after state after state where Trump would go, you realize, okay, this is going to happen. He can be the nominee. And, you know, the party bosses are not able to stop him, as preposterous as it might seem. I did not, however, think he would end up getting elected president. I thought there was a very real possibility he would win the presidency. And again, his rallies had a level of enthusiasm that you never saw for a Hillary Clinton event. And yet I still thought, really, we're going to have the reality TV impresario as president? But sure enough, it happened. And, you know, history, we all know what happened in 2016 and thereafter and the reasons for it. And we don't need to get into all that here.
No, because we've lived it.
But it was
right.
A powerful movement that cannot be denied.
Yeah, it was. And it was a major turning point in American history. I mean, I don't think anyone can deny that the country changed in a major way when he was elected. I still have a hard time getting those words out, saying Donald Trump was elected. But here we are. So in this book, I Alone Can Fix It, you guys decided to hone in on that last final year, which was, as you describe it in the title, catastrophic. We talked a moment about the clearing of Lafayette Square. That was June 1st. We were in the middle of the pandemic lockdown. Although the reason people were out in Lafayette Square is because these Black Lives Matter protests had sprung up around the country in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. There were some of us, look, right around the time when Trump was elected in 2016, I was diagnosed with lung cancer. And in August of that year, I had surgery. So I felt horrible, but I was not going out to the protests. But I watched everything, you know, because I was convalescing and obviously not willing to go out and put myself at risk for getting COVID, missing a lung. So, but things seemed to just spiral from that point. That day was horrific. I saw him attack the protesters. You wrote about it in the book, how he just wanted to sick the military on them. He wanted shots fired at them. He wanted protesters killed by military. Did he understand that that's not how we do things in the United States? Did he know that what he was calling for was completely against everything the Constitution says?
No, he did not understand that that was the way our government worked. He thought, his priority in those moments was to try to show strength and toughness and fortitude with an eye towards the November 3rd election, right? So he thought if he looked tough taking on Black Lives Matter protesters, he could win over more supporters for the election and wanted to use the military to aid him in that political purpose. And his advisors, including Bill Barr, the Attorney General, Defense Secretary Esper, and the aforementioned Mark Milley, yeah, they had to again and again explain to him, this is not an insurrection. These are civil protests, which are totally allowed in our country and constitutional. You cannot invoke the Insurrection Act. There's no legal basis for that. And you shouldn't send troops in, because if you send military troops in, you're asking for trouble. You're asking for another Waco or some sort of escalating incident. Right. Let law enforcement do their jobs enforcing the law and keep the federal response out of it. And Trump obliged reluctantly. But of course, he told Carol and me in our interview at Mar-a-Lago that was one of his big regrets as president, not just sending the military in. And if he could do it all over again, he would.
Oh, my God. So he not only didn't he learn, he learned the wrong lesson. So here you're saying that day on June 1st on the clearing of Lafayette Square, which was a peaceful protest, by the way, until the military came in and started, or the National Guard or whoever it was, and started firing tear gas and rubber bullets and things like that. And they made it a mess. It was peaceful up to that point. So they had to tell him, this is not an insurrection. This is a protest. On January 6th, did anybody tell him this is an insurrection?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if that word was used in private conversation with Trump that day. But what I can tell you about that day and what we learned in our reporting is that Trump watched it all unfold on television. He was transfixed by the images coming beaming at him from the screen. He actually liked what he saw. He liked seeing thousands of his supporters storming the Capitol. He liked seeing them waving Trump flags. He liked seeing the Make America Great Again hat. Yeah. He thought, here are his people in a show of force, defying the results of the election, trying to overturn the election. They were doing his will, his bidding. It wasn't until it became really violent and deadly that he was persuaded that this had gone too far and that he needed to call off his supporters. But that took multiple hours of pleading from Ivanka Trump, from Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, yep, and other advisors to get him to finally issue that video statement saying go home.
But even then it was still, we love you. You're wonderful.
That's
people.
Right.
You know, it's just like the whole thing was so surreal. Okay. So Phil, after the June 1st clearing of Lafayette Square, we're still in lockdown. He's feeling stuck in the White House because he's not out campaigning. Is that when he decided we're going to start up the rallies again? I don't care what the health experts say. We're going to go and we're going to start in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yeah, he wanted to get out there and do these rallies. And, you know, we have some reporting in the book about how Trump was determined to do an outdoor or to do a rally, a large scale rally somewhere in the country. They thought about trying to do it in Florida, thinking that the Republican governor there, Ron DeSantis, who was a big Trump ally, would greenlight it, would, yeah, approve of doing the rally in Florida, but they couldn't settle on the right location. And then they settled on Tulsa, Oklahoma, in that indoor arena rally. And what Trump learned, much to his dismay, people wouldn't show up. I mean, yeah, there were so many empty seats in that arena. It was a huge embarrassment for Trump, and it resulted in the firing, or the demotion, rather, of the campaign manager, Brad Parscale.
Well, not only did people not show up, he also got punked, basically, by TikTokers and, I guess, K-pop fans who didn't like Donald Trump and all RSVP'd for tickets. So they got over a million RSVPs for this event that, in the end, only about 6,000 people showed up for. And it was a major disaster. I mean, he made a big deal of, they had so many RSVPs, they're going to have this, it's spillover area outside. They have big screens set up. He's going to go out and speak to them. And none of this materialized. So maybe that's the first time he got a taste of it. However, he still had this event inside an arena at the height of the pandemic. And it did turn into a super spreader event. You wrote about the book in the book. I know it's on page like 199 or something, talking about the whole, when they got to Tulsa, some people were tested and a bunch of them came up as positive. And then they wanted to do more testing. Somebody within Trump's camp stopped the testing and said, nope, no one else is getting tested. You'll wait till we get back. Do you know who was responsible for saying, we're not going to do the testing here, we'll wait till we get back? Because that person might be responsible for some lives being lost.
Yeah, it's horrible to think about that. But we don't actually know who specifically issued that directive.
I gotcha. Well, it's shocking. And of course, you know, you had all the naysayers there. Herman Cain, who can forget Mr. 999, went to that rally. And 10 days later, he's dead.
Yeah.
And Trump still, I don't think I ever heard him say anything about it. Like, he's never, as far as I can tell, expressed any remorse for all these people who've died, and a lot of them due to his, you know, his behavior.
That's right. But, you know, Trump is not one to express remorse generally. So so it's not surprising.
I guess. No, I never expect to hear him express remorse. But do you think privately, does he know when he's lying, or does he believe his own crap?
You know, I don't know, because we can't get inside his head, right? I don't know what motivates him to say things that are not true. But I do think he's somebody who repeats a lie so many times that he just convinces himself that that's the truth.
Right.
Because when we sat down with him 2 months after the election ended and he continued to spread the election conspiracies and claim it was rigged, he did so with such apparent conviction. I mean, from his head to his toes, his whole body, I mean, he was fully committed to the lie. There was no wink. There was no sense of, you know, I'm doing this for theater. It was just, he was all in on the lie. And frankly, it's one of the more disturbing elements of our interview with him.
I'll bet. Because these habitual liars, we all know someone like that who just reels off a lie after lie after lie. And you realize after a while, they believe it because probably they've said it so often. But everything out of his mouth, as you said, it was like every sentence had a lie. So the first book you titled A Very Stable Genius, which the first time he said that, I mean, I laughed because I thought it was very funny. First thinking that he was saying that sort of as a self-deprecating thing. And then I realized, no, Trump doesn't do that. He's serious when he says this.
He's serious. And, you know, the funny thing about A Very Stable Genius is he didn't just say it once. No. He said it many times, multiple times. He tweeted it. This was a phrase that he kept coming back to again and again. And it's one of the reasons why Carol and I and our terrific book editor, Ann Godoff, selected it as the title of that book, because it just it was a way to use Trump's own words as sort of a mirror and
right.
hold it up and see if he lived up to that standard. And of course, you don't have to read very far into the book to conclude that most of the people around him did not consider him stable nor a genius.
And then this book you title I Alone Can Fix It. And I think he said that more than on one occasion. But the first time I know he said it was at the Republican convention in 2016 when he accepted the nomination. And let's just relive that moment because we can.
Nobody knows the system better than me.
It almost sounds like they're laughing when he first said that. And long pregnant
pause
here.
Which is why I alone can fix it.
And again, any other person, I don't know anyone who would say that, because I don't know anyone so self-centered. But again, does he believe this, or he just says it thinking that people will believe it and vote for him?
You know, again, I don't know. I think he says it thinking it's a selling point and he's trying to convince people of things. He's the consummate salesman, right? He was in real estate. He was on TV. He certainly was as a politician and president. But his whole pitch in 2016 to voters was, I'm the business guy. I can solve all your problems. I can cut through the crap and fix everything that's broken about Washington. He ended up not fixing very much at all. He couldn't even fix his own election in the end. And that's one of the reasons why we picked this title for this book, because again, it's Trump's own words. It's the vow he made to the American people that he could fix the problems. And I think our book shows that he didn't fix problems. He made them worse.
All right. Last question for you. Do you think Trump will ever be held accountable for the many lies he told that cost a lot of lives, that hurt a lot of people, that put this country into turmoil? Will he ever, or he'll just keep riding off like Teflon Don?
it depends on what you mean by held accountable. I think the voters held him accountable by denying him a second term as president. But he's obviously not served any time in jail or been held accountable in any criminal matter. And that's to be determined. I'm no expert in that field. Obviously, there are the ongoing New York investigations, but there could potentially be other investigations down the road. There's certainly there's the probe in Georgia looking into the election fraud claims and on and on and on. So I think he will continue to face that kind of scrutiny. I don't know whether any judge or jury will ever hold him accountable in a meaningful way. But I think it's pretty bruising for him and for his ego to have been held accountable by the voters of this country the way he was on November 3rd.
Sure. Okay, one last one. As a journalist, are you at all concerned about the ball he set in motion now going on, what, 40-some-odd states that are putting in this new legislation for a partisan elected official to take control of each state's election apparatus? This is kind of frightening to me. This is what I see as a lasting legacy of Trump, is the, you know, yes is no, up is down thing. And certainly, oh, by the way, we're going to overturn your elections.
Certainly, you know, it's alarming to a lot of Democrats and progressives. And I think it's one of the reasons why there's been such a forceful engagement on this issue from President Biden and all the way down through the party, because this is a real threat to the functioning of American democracy and to the preservation of the right for so many people and ability of so many people to vote in this country.
Well, we still have our work cut out for us just dealing with the aftermath of Trump. Thank you for the book and the great work that you and Carol and your colleagues at The Washington Post do. I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. And if you want to feel those knots in your stomach again, just open the book to any page and start reading. Phil Rucker, it was great to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you a lot, Nicole. I appreciate it. Good to talk to you.
You too. There you go. Philip Rucker. Philip Rucker. Ooh, it would help if I pulled that down and get rid of the echo. All right, we're taking a break on Progressive Voices. I thought I'd jump in and say, that was a great interview. I feel bad for these authors who have to do interview after interview after interview. It's got to get tedious after a while. So hopefully I threw something a little different in the mix. I don't know. But hey, that's the payoff. You have a big book and you have to do the interviews. So I appreciate that they let me do it. By the way, if you are a reader, you know, I have a stack of books a mile high from interviews that I've done. A great way to help the show and help me out is if you hear an interview with an author and it's a book that you'd be interested in, send me an email, make sure it's still available. But for a donation that covers, you know, the postage and a little extra, I'll send you the book, because I read some of them. To be honest with you, I don't have a whole lot of time and I don't have this one, I'm still, you know, this one was embargoed. So I just got this like 2 days ago. And it's a pretty thick book. So this one I actually want to read. But just last week, I spoke to Michael Bender, and I got, you know, I got maybe a third of the way into this book. This one's already, the Frankly We Did Win This Election, this one's already spoken for. But it's another way to support the show. And BB in the chat room, thank you so much. YouTube has a feature called Super Chat where you can donate to a show that you enjoy. And B just made a donation. And B, I can't thank you enough. If you hear a book, for instance, well, you know, I was going to say I have Julie K. Brown coming on Monday, but I didn't get a physical copy of that book. I just have the Kindle edition. But anyway, if you do hear me interview an author and it's a book you're interested in, email me. If I have it available, you know, I'll gladly part with it, because I've got what I need to do is in my spare time, put up a sort of a library page on the website at NicoleSandler.com. And let you know which books are available. We've got some good ones. I've had some good guests on recently. So we can do that. B says, I'm reading The Road to Unfreedom by Timothy Snyder. Man, it's scary, depressing. See, I don't need scary, depressing. I get enough of those. But I do have, Tom Hartman has a new book coming out. So I've got that one in the stack that I'm starting to read. What others? I'm always booking ahead. There's some other really, really good ones. There's this guy, Adam Tooze, who wrote a book about a year ago, Crash, I think it was called. I just remember it was a fascinating interview. Well, he's got a new one coming out called Shutdown, and it's about how the economy will weather the pandemic. So that one is, I just booked today for September 8th, so we're working way in advance. Let me tell you what else is coming up on the show. Tomorrow is Thursday, so Howie Klein will be here, and he's bringing along Bruno Amato. Bruno Amato is running for Congress from the district in California, now represented by Kevin McCarthy. And I think you'd agree with me, if anyone deserves to go home right now, it's Kevin McCarthy. And so Howie last Thursday, you know, tweeted something out that Bruno is going to join us on the show tomorrow. And I've gotten more retweets on that than anything in a while. So there's a lot of interest in him. How awesome would it be? Kevin McCarthy thinks, you know, there's a good chance that the Republicans could take back the House. Kevin McCarthy thinks he's going to be Speaker. How awesome would it be if he loses in the election to Bruno Amato? So you'll meet him tomorrow. And then on Friday, we're gonna take a break from the politics, because Friday is a day that I'm guessing some of the people in listening now will remember. 40 years ago, Sunday, actually, August 1st, if I have the date right, is the 40th anniversary of MTV, the beginning of MTV. Do you remember how it started? Well, if you don't, we'll refresh your memory. On Friday, I will be joined by Mark Goodman. Mark Goodman, one of the original MTV VJs. So just something different, because God knows we need a change. I'll tell you something. Today, I wake up, I'm still reeling a bit from yesterday's testimony, and I turn on CNN, and I see Officer Michael Fanone. And Michael Fanone is there and talking about what the idiots on Fox did last night, how they laughed at the testimony and poo-pooed it. And, you know, Laura Ingraham, I know it's Ingram, I just mispronounce her name on purpose because I can, because I'm pronouncing it as it's spelled. Laura Ingraham was saying, oh, he wins an acting award. You get a life. But he shared something. While this hearing was going on yesterday, while Michael Fanone was testifying about how he was beaten unconscious on January 6th by Trump supporters, he was unconscious, they guessed from his body cam video, it seemed to be about 4 minutes. He suffered traumatic brain injury, among other injuries. While he was testifying, some cretin called his phone and left him a voicemail message. Now, I put the warning at the beginning of the show because chances are pretty good that at some point during the show, you know, I'll let slip a four-letter word. And just know, I spent almost 40 years on the radio. I only cursed once. And it wasn't, I thought the mic was off, and I just, it was just a reaction to something that happened on the air. I thought I turned off the mic and I went, shit. And someone quickly ran in and said, your mic is on. Only time I ever cursed on the air in a very long radio career. So I'm capable of it, but I don't have the FCC on my back on the internet, so I can say whatever I want. So anyway, I play a disclaimer at the beginning of the show saying, you know, there's language that will likely be used here, but I'm going to warn you again right now. I'm going to play this voicemail message that somebody left for Michael Fanone and when he was testifying yesterday, and it's horrific. And I'm not offended by words, but what this cretin on the other end of the phone said to this man is offensive in every aspect. So I'm warning you now. if you offend easily, you want to turn down the radio for 56 seconds because that's how long this rant goes on. And they aired it on CNN this morning because Michael Fanone wanted everyone to hear exactly what this person said. And just know that these are Trump supporters. Here's the message.
From Michael Fanone, Metropolitan Police Officer, you're on trial right now, lying. And you want an Emmy, an Oscar? What are you trying to go for here?
Oh, my God.
You're so full of shit, you little faggot fucker. You're a little pussy, man. I could slap you up the side of your head with a backhand and knock you out, you little faggot. You're a punk faggot. You're a lying fuck. How about all that scummy black fucking scum for 2 years, destroying our cities and burning them and stealing all that shit out of the stores and everything? How about that and assaulting cops and killing people? How about that, you fucker? That was shit on the goddamn Capitol. I wish they would have killed all you scumbags because you people are scum. They stole the election from Trump, and you know that, you scumbag. And you fucking, too bad they didn't beat the shit out of you more. You're a piece of shit. You're a little fag, you fucking scumbag.
It sounds like a couple of the callers I get regularly. Pat in Albuquerque, for example. Anyway, that's the kind of shit. And I really hope the FBI or whoever can trace that call from Michael Fanone's phone to whoever placed that call, because that guy deserves a taste of his own medicine. By the way, yes, that is all they got, Diane Russell. And yes, it's ugly. And yeah, this is who they are. When they tell you who they are, listen, we've learned who they are. And Trump is one of them. By the way, General Honoré, who Nancy Pelosi brought in, he's the one who oversaw the response to Katrina. Nancy Pelosi brought him in to help oversee the security at the Capitol after January 6th. And he was on MSNBC. I think this was today. Now, here's the problem. It's not only me when I have guests on and there's a shitty connection, or, you know, the audio is lousy and it cuts in and out. So that's what happened with General Honoré today, but you can still hear what he's saying, and what he said is really important. So I'm going to play it, and if I have to, I will stop it and clarify, what he said. Again, this is General Honoré talking about the January 6th insurrection.
Many indications here that the executive branch was complicit. And what happened on 1-6.
The executive branch was
complicit.
From
what I see on television, not based on our investigation we did to prevent future attacks on the Capitol with training and intelligence police. But what's coming out clear is that the executive branch was complicit.
The executive branch was
and
complicit.
And maybe certain agency leadership members may have been complicit.
And maybe certain agencies' leadership may have been complicit. That's what he's saying. And it continues. I just wanted to say those words are coming through loud and clear. Executive branch and some agencies' leadership were complicit. This is General Honoré talking.
Listening at these officers this morning and the hell they went through, as we all watched on television, and as the people questioning them today who were victims of that attack, that we got two narratives in America. One of them, the followers of the former president that deny it happened this way. And then the victims, the members of the House and Senate themselves, and these brave police officers who took the brunt of the damage that day.
When you say the executive branch was complicit, the Trump White House was complicit in this attack, are you able to assign names? And I ask you that because you conducted that security assessment. And to Clint's question, do you know who was in touch with the Department of Defense? Do you know why there was that delay in getting more law enforcement to the Capitol as frantic calls
Good
were
question.
Made for reinforcements?
No, this was not a part of my investigation. It's my personal opinion that the executive branch was complicit in the planning and the delayed response
the that delayed occurred, response that occurred
in bringing in both fellow citizens to the Capitol that day. That's my own perception based on what I've seen and what I've heard, and by the fact that the former president continuing to tell people this was not a riot, it meant no harm, it was like a picnic, it was like a stroll. He was complicit, because the last I heard from him, he told them to go to the Capitol and raise hell.
Yeah. So there's General Honoré saying in a bit muddled phone call, but we heard him loud and clear, that he believes the executive branch was complicit. And he even cited Donald Trump telling them to go to the Capitol. Yeah. So this is what those four officers said when they were asked yesterday, what would you like to see from this committee? And they all said it slightly differently, but the end game was the same. We want you to find out who was behind this, who organized it, who was calling the shots. General Honoré there said he believes that the executive branch was not only complicit in planning it, but also in the delayed response. In this book, and we didn't really get into it, but I know they do get into it in the book, further along than I am in my reading of it. Donald Trump sat there that day on January 6th and did nothing. Even Ivanka had to come and plead with him to do something, call off your goons, and he sat there enjoying it. It was Mike Pence who was on the phone with the military, with the National Guard, trying to get something going. Donald Trump did nothing because that was exactly what he wanted to happen. It's really sickening. It's really horrible. And therefore, during the hearing yesterday, I was particularly interested in Officer Hodges. He's the one who was trapped in that doorway. We saw that video the first day. We saw that, and we've seen it countless times since. He referred to the insurrectionists not as rioters, but as terrorists. And Jamie Raskin, who was on the committee, asked him why he calls them terrorists.
I hope every American reads your testimony. But I noted that you referred to terrorists or terrorism 15 different times to describe the people who were assaulting officers, dragging them through the crowd, stealing their weapons, smashing them over the head, gouging eyes, and so on. However, some of our colleagues have been calling the violent insurrectionists not terrorists, but tourists.
Yeah.
Why do you call the attackers terrorists? And what do you think about our colleagues who think we should call them tourists?
Well, if that's what American tourists are like, I can see why foreign countries don't like American tourists.
True.
But I can see why someone would take issue with the title of terrorist. It's gained a lot of notoriety in our vocabulary in the past few decades. And we like to believe that, no, that couldn't happen here. No domestic terrorism, no homegrown threats. But I came prepared. U.S. Code, Title 18, Part 1, Chapter 113, B as in Brown, Section 2331.
Listen to this.
The term domestic terrorism means activities that involve acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state. And B, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, or to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping, and occur primarily within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States.
Fitz. They were domestic terrorists. That's the statute on domestic terrorism, and that accurately described the insurrectionists, the people who went into the Capitol and were out for blood. They were hunting Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence. They, remember Hang Mike Pence? Yeah. This is a day we cannot forget, and we can't let the cretins on Fox and those other channels that nobody watches, reframe history. We know what happened. We need to keep calling it out. We need to keep putting it in, shoving it in their faces. That hearing yesterday was awesome. They need to have a couple of them every week. From now until whenever. Keep them coming, because we need them. All right, with that, stick a fork in it. The show is done. Tomorrow, Howie Klein and Bruno Amato will be here. And Friday, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of MTV. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'll see you tomorrow. And take good care. Wear a mask. Be careful. COVID's still there. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
So many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
That is Officer Michael Fanone testifying in the first hearing held by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol by a mob of the former guy's supporters. Four police officers who defended Congress testified about their experiences. Officer Fanone was beaten unconscious and suffered a heart attack and ongoing traumatic brain injury. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn said rioters wearing Trump paraphernalia called him the N-word and worse.
One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This nigger voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo, fucking nigger." No one had ever, ever called me a nigger while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer.
Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gunnell, who underwent surgery to address his injuries from the insurrection, described the attack as a, quote, medieval battle his army and police training didn't prepare him for. Officer Hodges described being crushed, footage we've seen dozens of times.
On my left was a man with a clear riot shield stolen during the assault. He slammed it against me and, with all the weight of the bodies pushing behind him, trapped me. My arms were pinned and effectively useless, trapped against either the shield on my left or the door frame on my right. With my posture granting me no functional strength or freedom of movement, I was effectively defenseless and gradually sustaining injury from the increasing pressure of the mob. Directly in front of me, a man seized the opportunity of my vulnerability, grabbed the front of my gas mask, and used it to beat my head against the door. He switched to pulling it off my head, the straps stretching against my skull and straining my neck. He never uttered any words I recognized, but opted instead for guttural screams. I remember him foaming at the mouth. Eventually, he succeeded in stripping away my gas mask, and a new rush of exposure to CS and OC spray hit me. The mob of terrorists were coordinating their efforts now, shouting, "Heave! Ho!" as they synchronized, pushing their weight forward, crushing me further against the metal doorframe. The man in front of me grabbed my baton that I still held in my hands, and in my current state, I was unable to retain my weapon. He bashed me in the head and face with it, rupturing my lip and adding additional injury to my skull.
Committee member Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who was appointed by Speaker Nancy Pelosi and dismissed as a, quote, Pelosi Republican by Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, said the committee's mission is to ensure accountability. Republicans opposed to the investigation called it a sham. And the Fox Not News channel's mocking of the hearing Tuesday night was just sickening. In other news, the Center for Disease Control on Tuesday issued a new guidance advising people to wear masks in public indoor settings, even if they are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus. This change, which critics called unnecessary, comes as the Delta variant fuels a surge of new infections, especially in Missouri, Arkansas, and of course here in Florida and other states with low vaccination rates. The CDC also urged schools to require that all students, teachers, and staff wear masks when schools reopen in the fall. Of course, the Flat Earth Society on the right is calling foul. Dr. Fauci, though, says the new guidance is because the virus has changed, not the science behind its prevention. President Biden also plans to announce on Thursday that his administration will require all federal employees and contractors to be vaccinated against COVID-19 or undergo regular tests and mitigation. Biden is also expected to announce incentives and other steps to get more Americans vaccinated against the virus as the virulent Delta strain drives a new infection surge. Turning towards the Olympics, oh man, gymnastics superstar Simone Biles withdrew from the Olympics team final on Tuesday after a disappointing vault performance. She said she was still struggling with stress and other emotional issues and was not in the right place mentally for the final. The U.S. team without Biles won a silver medal, coming in behind the Russian team. And overnight, Biles decided to withdraw from the individual all-around competition that will happen on Thursday in order to focus on her mental health. Still undecided is whether she'll compete in the individual competitions still to come. In the pool, U.S. swimmer Katie Ledecky won a gold medal in the Olympic debut of the women's 1,500-meter freestyle race on Wednesday. That was just about an hour after she fell short of a medal for the first time in her Olympic career. It was Ledecky's first gold of the Tokyo Olympics. Need a bit of inspiration? Then look toward Texas, where the Reverend William Barber and former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke launched a four-day, 27-mile march across the state against Republican-led voter suppression. They're calling on Congress to end the filibuster and pass voting rights legislation. During what they describe as a Selma to Montgomery-style march for democracy, activists are pausing at three churches and a Muslim community center. They'll end with a rally at the Texas state capitol. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.